This is Radio Boston. I'm Carrie Goldberg.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
Go to a local bookstore's self-help section and you'll see a flood of titles on how to be happy.
But one small country at the eastern end of the Himalayas has centered its entire public policy around that very goal, being happy.
Bhutan has become known for focusing more on gross national happiness than gross national product. But even in what some have called the last Shangri-La, consumerism is seeping in.
The country is expecting more tourists as it opens up to new flights from India. Policymakers are debating whether to join the World Trade Organization. TV is being introduced. Drug abuse, domestic violence, and vandalism are popping up for the first time.
With us now to dig into the questions that Bhutan is wrestling with is Madeline Drexler, editor of Harvard Public Health magazine and a senior fellow at Brandeis University's Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism. She's the author of the new e-book, A Splendid Isolation, Lessons on Happiness from the Kingdom of Bhutan. Madeline, welcome. So you're a health journalist. Your last book was actually about infectious disease. What drew you to Bhutan?
I remember very vividly being a college student, so I was maybe around 20. I was reading the newspaper and I read this little squib that said, the Himalayan nation of Bhutan only permits 2,500 tourists a year. And instantly, I knew I had to go there.
Okay, so Madeline, most of us will probably never get to Bhutan. Could you kind of take us there in our imagination for a moment? Let's say you and I are on the main drag of the capital, Thimphu. What's it like?
Well, the very first thing that struck me on the first Friday evening I was there was physically how people relate to each other. Teenage boys, how they comport themselves. They're swaggering, of course, but their arms are slung over each other's shoulders, you know, and they speak
affectionately.
They speak in very gentle voices, too. You will notice stray dogs everywhere because they very assertively inhabit the city. If you're in Thimphu or really anywhere, you're going to hear singing. It will come from men who are engaged in these matches of archery or darts.
Architecturally, what does it look like?
Architecturally, it's also surprising because by law, they must construct buildings according to the traditional aesthetic, which is stucco and timber. No buildings can be more than six stories high. You know, there are no auteurist architectural statements there. When I read about that here in the U.S., I thought, well, wow, that's kind of authoritarian. Mm-hmm. But actually, when you go to Bhutan, you see that there's a beautiful harmony of buildings set into the countryside.
Of course, Bhutan is most famous for this gross national happiness policy, which is kind of starting to catch on around the world, I understand, in other places. It really led the pack on that. How did its GNH policy get started?
Until the early 1960s, Bhutan was practically a medieval society. Mm-hmm. The average life expectancy was 33 years. Whew. The per capita income was
$51. $51?
Yeah. The agriculture was completely subsistence. There were no roads. There were no cars. No electricity, no postal system, and I think in the whole country there were two doctors. And then everything started to change in the early 60s. Bhutan, in a tentative way, started opening up to the world. They started building roads and schools and hospitals. And then in the early 1970s, along comes this visionary young king. He's known as the Fourth Dragon King. Mm. And he's the one who coined this brilliant, witty phrase, gross national happiness. His idea was, we're a materially poor country, but we're not going to make the same mistakes as other developing countries around us who have the same economic ambitions. Mm-hmm. In Bhutan, what's going to be more important than gross national product is gross national happiness.
Interesting. And how do you measure this happiness then?
It's really based on what they call the four pillars: good governance, sustainable socioeconomic development, cultural preservation, environmental conservation. Those are sort of the keys. And then under those are what's known as the nine domains. And actually, it's in these nine domains that the personality of this policy really comes through. Not only are they measuring what we think of as standard, you know, development milestones like wealth, like healthcare, et cetera, but they also measure psychological well-being. Mm-hmm. Another one is community vitality. Hmm. They even track people's balanced use of time. Part of the national agenda is that people, by rights, must have time away from work to enjoy their families, you know, their friends, their hobbies, their spiritual pursuits.
So here we have this central way that Bhutan chose to go its own way, to, in a way, be ahead of the rest of the world by thinking about what really matters. But at the same time, you write that now Bhutan is facing these challenges of the rest of the world, including all its negative phenomena, seeping in. What's happening?
Bhutan is a country that is coming out of its splendid isolation, mm-hmm. and it happens to be at a time when the economy is weak. Young people are out of jobs. There's rising crime, although it still comparatively is a very safe country. There's alcoholism. There's drug abuse. So, you know, in this new economy, some people are making money, others are not, and there's also a widening income inequality. Uh-huh. You know, someone told me they didn't think that gross national happiness would work in the capital. There's also a massive rural to urban migration. And so this, what was, you know, 50 years ago a purely subsistence agriculture nation, is going to become highly urbanized.
So it feels like we're at this crux point now. And the question is, can the spirit that created gross national happiness, can that spirit survive these challenges?
It's sort of poised between tradition and this rush toward material security and social media, you know, and all the things that we in the affluent West take for granted. So last July, actually, there was a very surprising development. It was their second national democratic elections, and they voted in this pro-business, small government, sort of libertarian-minded party. So Bhutan, you know, is caught in this classic bind of a developing nation. And what I heard all the time as I was traveling through was people lamenting, what if Bhutan is someday no longer Bhutan?
Getting back to you individually, you write that the very act of contemplating happiness in Bhutan made you happy. What was the secret there that might potentially be shared with other people?
Well, you would think, you know, Americans would be happy, right? Because there's a torrent of books about happiness in the United States. But when you talk to the Bhutanese about what makes for happiness, they don't emphasize the individual. They emphasize the collective. You know, one of the questions they ask is, can an individual be happy if others suffer? I'm not saying they have all the answers, but I do think they're asking original questions. And to me, they seemed, on the whole, happier than Americans.
Well, and it sounds like they're asking a different question. They're not asking, how can I be happy? They're asking, how can we be happy?
That's exactly right.
Interesting. Now, they're a Buddhist country. Is there any sort of quintessentially Buddhist element in all of this?
In Bhutan, the official line is that GNH could be applied in any country, that it's not Buddhist. But my impression when I traveled through the country was that it was almost impossible to separate Bhutanese culture and GNH from Buddhism. I mean, I came away with the idea that Bhutan was probably a GNH country before there was GNH.
Yes, it was. Now, Madeline, you spoke to the secretary of the Gross National Happiness Commission, who said something striking about what he misses when he leaves Bhutan. What did he say?
He couldn't just walk up to someone and smile and say something. He felt that there was so little trust between people in other countries that somehow human relations had broken down. He said, I would like to have this as a GNH indicator, that today, if you are a visitor in Bhutan, someone will walk up to you and start talking to you for 20 minutes for no reason. This is a good indicator of a flourishing society, that humanity exists, and not everything is about buying and selling and transactions, that you can have spontaneous exchanges just because we happen to inhabit this planet and share this precious life at the same time.
Oh, that's beautiful. I don't think Boston would do very well on the 20-minute test. Madeline, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Carrie.
That's Madeline Drexler, editor of Harvard Public Health Magazine and senior fellow at Brandeis University's Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism. She's author of the new ebook, A Splendid Isolation. For an excerpt, you can go to our website, radioboston.org.
And stay with us. Coming up, Angélique Kidjo, the queen of African music, is coming to Boston with a new album honoring the women of Africa. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Carrie Goldberg. This is Radio Boston.